Here we go. All righty. We are on Yud Amud Aleph. We just discussed the sad state of a person who had been learned in Torah and went away from Torah. That's something that's made crooked that cannot be repaired. That was the last thing we talked about. So a couple more lines to the Mishnah. We're going to bring another pasuk in Zechariah that mentions the following, and we'll learn something from that as well. The pasuk says, "Uliyotze vilabo ein shalom," and to one who goes or comes, there is no peace. Okay, that means this was describing the difficult situations in building the second base of Mikdash. And our Gemara is going to continue. It's going to talk about a person who left Torah. So he's going to explain like this. Amar Rav. Rav interprets the verse as follows. Kiven sheyaitza adam midvar halacha. Once a person leaves. It says they leave and they come, they don't have peace. Once a person leaves the words of halacha, meaning he leaves his learning and he lowers the level. Let's say the guy was used to learning Mishnayos. And he leaves learning Mishnayos to learn a lower level of just Chumash, which is a lower level of learning. So he's leaving a higher level and going to a lower level. Shuv ein lo shalom. He will no longer have any peace. Why will he have no peace? What the Gemara means is, if you know, Chumash itself, you can't know how to live like a Jew by just reading the biblical text. It's not enough information. You wouldn't know how to keep Shabbos, right? Now there's a whole Mishnayos Shabbos that at least tells you the 39 prohibited activities. At least tells a little bit more. So and really, when the Mishnah was first written in the olden days, that was to become the source of the halacha. That would teach you how to live your life. So we're saying a guy who was used to learning Mishnah, and now he stopped, and now he's going to a lower level, just learning the biblical text. He has no peace, meaning he won't know what to do. He's not going to remember the halachas, and therefore he'll have no peace. That's one interpretation. Shmuel Omer, Shmuel says, no, it means, that puzzle means, Zehaporesh mi Talmud l'mishneh. It's a person who had been used to learning Talmud, and now he descends down to Mishnah, because the Talmud analyzes the Mishnah, gives reasons for the Mishnah. And if you leave that higher level and go to the lower one, you won't be able ultimately to know the halacha properly, because many Mishnayos, although it says halacha, but it doesn't give it complete halacha. There's a lot of contradictions and conflicts. So he says we have to, I mean, it's a downgrade from a much higher level of learning Gemara to a lower level of Mishnah. One more interpretation of Yochanan Amar, you know what? Afilu mishas l'shas. Shas stands for the Talmud. Shas is an acronym. Shin Samach. Shin stands for Shisha. Samach stands for Sidre, the six orders. And that's what the Talmud is. It's the six orders of the Talmud. There's six sections of the Talmud. And there's two Talmuds. There's the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud was written before the Babylonian Talmud. It was written much briefer, more cryptic, not as much analysis. And therefore, we say that the Babylonian Talmud is the more authoritative Talmud. So he's going to say, look what he says. So it would apply even if you go from one type of Talmud to another. Let's see what the notes say. That is, he abandons the Talmud Yerushalmi and studies the Bavli. The Gemara in Sanhedrin interprets the verse that says, he placed me in darkness like the eternally dead, as alluding to the Talmud Bavli, which is dark. Why? In the sense that his teachings are deep and not readily understood. It's very hard, much harder than the Yerushalmi, which is briefer and just says the laws. Or it's the alternative, the Talmud Bavli is described as dark because the Amoraim of Talmud Bavli did not yield to one another. They didn't give in. They kept fighting. And thus sometimes it's inconclusive. There's been many Gemaras we've learned and we came to no conclusion. There was an argument, no solution.
It's not that often, isn't it?
I thought it was pretty often.
Pretty often.
When we were learning Kiddushin and Ksuvas, all the time. They're arguing left, right, and center.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Now, that's one way of learning. So in other words, the Jerusalem Talmud was easier because they didn't make so much arguments and they came to resolutions. So you leave the one that has clarity, and you go to the one that has lack of clarity. You'll have no peace. That's one way of learning it. The other commentaries, Tosri takes the opposite approach. Yeah. So you have a machlokas on how to learn this. He understands the Gemara as referring to one who abandons the Talmud Bavli for the sake of the Yerushalmi. Why? Since the Bavli provides greater explanation than the Yerushalmi, a student might switch Yerushalmi because he wishes to study more superficially. Now, one more interpretation. Tosfos refers to one who switches from either Talmud to the other. Any switch. Why? If a student abandons either Talmud before understanding it, he will lack the clarity required to reach valid halachic decisions.
So that's the key, before understanding it, because if you finish study one and you think you understood everything, you can go to the next one, but if you didn't...
That's right. Well, exactly. How are you gonna know? Exactly. Okay, that's the end of the Gemara. We now begin a new Mishnah. Great. I hope. One second. Okay, now... One second. Okay. The Gemara now is going to, this is on all Agadata, even the Mishnah is a non-halachic Mishnah. Very interesting type of Mishnah, as you're going to see now. The Gemara is going to say, where are certain areas of halacha, how do they fit into being sourced in the Torah or not? Some things are very clear, you know, for example, this week's Parsha. This week's Parsha that talks about Saras, if you want to know anything about the law of Saras, the Torah is extremely detailed. You could read the text. It's like looking in the Shulchan Aruch, like I said. It's all there. It's really clear. Other things, parts of the Torah, there's very little in the Torah itself. Maybe a hint, just a hint. And there's mounds of halacha that come from it. So the Mishnah is going to list a number of areas of Jewish law and discussing how limited is the source in the Bible, but still we have these halachas. And that's what the Mishnah is going to talk about. And you have to remember, what Hashem gave Moshe at Sinai, verbally, was everything. Everything. But not everything that he spoke to him did he tell him to write into the Torah. You have to remember that. People make a big mistake. Some things are clearly written in the Torah, while others are left to the oral explanation. Now, for example, let's give an example how it relates to our Gemara. Other precepts of the Torah, such as the obligation to bring the Chagiga offering, that's our Masechta, right, are known only through oral tradition. It didn't say in the Chumash, it says you celebrate. It doesn't say you bring a Chagiga offering. That's part of the tradition that Hashem gave to Moshe. So now we're going to have other examples where it's only alluded to, and we start with the first one over here, Heter Nedorim. Heter Nedorim means releasing someone from a vow. When a person makes a vow, let's say right now I get up and say, I make a vow, I am no longer going to have any chocolate cake or any fattening desserts. If I make that vow, it's binding. Now that, the Torah tells us that. The Torah says that. Now if I would, God forbid, after making such a vow, if I would eat a piece of chocolate cake, I would be sinning. It would be a sin. Forget about health. For me, it's like it's treif. Okay. Now let's say, after a couple of weeks, I'm going crazy. I've got such a chocolate
craving.
I'm going out of my mind. Now, what you're allowed to do, you can go to a court or a big rabbi and say, I'd like you to release me from the vow. Now, it's not so simple. You can't just say, well, I changed my mind. It works something like this. It's a whole masechta on this. He says like this, if at the time when you made the vow, did you think that even if you'd have incredible cravings and withdrawal, you'd still want to refrain with it? Would you have thought that at the time or not? So the guy says, no, if I knew how bad it would be, I never would have done it. At that point, he can release him from the vow. It's like retroactively annulled. It can't just be where the guy says, you know, that was a nice thing and I'm bored of it now. And now I'd like to go back to chocolate. Well, then that's not so simple. Not so easy to bring it back. You know, that's the whole thing. The whole thing we do on Erev Rosh Hashanah, we get in front of three people and do Hataras Nedarim. That's the same thing. We said that any vow that I may have made that I didn't realize, that I don't know of, I want you to annul it, if it's allowed to be annulled. So this whole area of annulling vows, you look from the beginning of the Torah to the end of the Torah, doesn't say a word. Doesn't say a word. That's why the Mishnah says now, Heter Nedarim, the whole concept of releasing people from vows, we refer to as Porchim Bavir. It's like they're flying in the air. Means that it's not grounded. It's not go point to a text that's on the ground over here. You're not going to find it there. There is laws of making vows in the Torah, and that's in Parshas Matos. It talks about a woman making a vow, and the husband can say, "I don't want the vow to even begin." The Torah talks about that. If a young daughter makes a vow, the father can say, "I don't want it to begin." But it doesn't talk about if the person wants to change his mind and wants it released. There's no overt text for that. Okay, so that's number one. They flying in the air, and the ve'ein lahem amashis, well, they have no scriptural support. You will not, if a second Jew says, where does it say in your Torah you can't do it? Sorry, there is no source. How do you know? Hashem told Moshe about it. Why do you not write in the Torah? That's God's business. So that's one area. The Gemara, not later, maybe today, is going to say, even though there's no support, there's a hint. There has to always be at least a hint. So tomorrow I'll bring four opinions or five that will say different interpretations of what the hint is. So it's not possible that anything that we do, there isn't at least some kind of a hint to it in the Torah. We'll see. But clear, black and white, you will not find it by that. That's number one. Next area of halacha, Hilchas Shabbos. What about the laws of Shabbos? This is where now it relates to our Masechta. This is why we're putting this Mishnah in here. Or Chagigos, or the Chagiga offering, the holiday offering. And number three, Vahame'ilos, and the concept of being Mo'el. Mo'el means using consecrated objects that have been dedicated to the Beis HaMikdash. If I say, I donate this tape recorder to the Beis HaMikdash, I'm giving it to the Beis HaMikdash. At this point, it's holy. Now, I'm prohibited to use it for my personal use. I give them some interest, they can sell it, they can get some money for it, whatever, but I can't use it. If I use it, the word is called me'ilo. That's called misappropriating that which has been consecrated. So these are three areas of halacha. Shabbos, bringing the Korban Chagiga, and misappropriating consecrated things. What about them? They are hareihem keharorim. They are like mountains, hataluim bisa'ara, that are suspended by a hair. What does that mean? Well, a mountain is big, yeah? A hair is something. Is a hair something? Yeah, but it's very thin. So what does it mean? The Mishnah explains. Shehei mikram, with very little scriptural sources for this, but v'halachas merubos, but lots of halacha, okay? In other words, just like a mountain suspended on a hair. In other words, yes, the Torah says you have to keep Shabbos. Okay, that's fine. Now, if I would not have any oral law, I would say Shabbos, okay, I don't go to work on Shabbos, I go shopping, I turn the lights on, I go in a car, anything but work. Okay, well, that's not the case. There's 39 prohibited activities. We don't know any of them from the Torah. So these are big mountains suspended on a hair. Yeah, there is a verse. We're not going to say the releasing a vow. There's not even a verse. Shabbos at least has a verse. Chagiga a little bit has a verse. Me'ilah has a little verse. But for all the law that it has, pretty skimpy on the verse. So that's the second area we've talked about. And now the final area. Hadinim, monetary laws, the ha'avodos, and the laws regarding sacrifices in the Beis HaMikdash. Hataharas, the laws of purity, v'atameos, and contamination, which is this week's parsha. And arayas, and prohibited relationships, which is mostly next week's parsha, and parsha's kedoshim. Yesh lahem amash yismu. There is real scriptural support. lots of detail about that. And Vehein Hein Gufei Torah, and they're the fundamentals of the Torah. The Gemara is going to ask a question on that. What do you mean to say? Shabbos is not a fundamental of the Torah? The Gemara will explain what that means later. So the Mishnah has described three types of areas of halacha. You have areas where there's absolutely no scriptural support for that, such as releasing vows. You have minimal scriptural and tons of law, like the Shabbos, etc. And then we have where it's all out there. There's a lot, and the monetary laws. It's a whole Parshas Mishpatim, Sefer Dvarim, a few Parshas. Lots of law and lots of text. Okay, that's the Mishnah. Gemara now is going to say, wait a minute, I take exception. Gemara is going to say, this is this Mishnah. This Mishnah says that releasing of vows has no textual support. Gemara now is going to bring a braisa that's going to disagree with the Mishnah. What do you mean there's no textual support? I will bring you a textual support. Tanya, we learn in a braisa. Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Rabbi Eliezer disagrees with the Mishnah, says, Yesh lahem al-mashi yismachu. The releasing of vows has some type of textual support. How do we know? Shenemar, how does the beginning of the section dealing with vows begin? It begins with the words, ki yafli. Let's look for a minute. It's Parshas Noso. It's important to see this inside. Pasuk says, Pasuk Beis, Taber al b'nei Yisrael, speak to people for Martha and say, Isha isha, man or woman. Now here's an unusual word. Ki yafli lindor neder nazir lahazul Hashem. When a person will, we won't translate the word yafli for a moment, but verse will lindor neder, makes a vow, or nazir lahazir, or makes upon himself a vow to be a nazir lahashem. And then it goes on and discusses all the laws of a nazir. And that's a vow. That's one of the vows. And we go through the, all the laws of a vow that can't drink wine, etc., 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 etc. Now, the introductory word, this is the issue here. Ki yafli. Yafli is a very unusual word, and the commentaries deal with it at great length. What it means, literally means a wondrous thing. Does a wondrous thing to vow, to abstain from wine, etc., etc. Now, this is one kind of vow, okay? So that's the word you got to keep in mind, the word yafli. All right? Now, so it says, Shenemar ki yafli when it comes to vows. It also says, ki yafli somewhere else. Okay? It also says, if a man shall clearly utter, let's take a look over here in Vayikra, Chav Zayin Beis. It's in two different places in the Torah. Okay, here's an interesting thing. Daber al b'nei Yisrael, pasuk beis also. I mean, ish ki yafli neder. Again, if a man will yafli, will wondrously make a neder. So very similar wordings, but here's a different realm of halacha. Be'er kachon nefashosem. He makes a vow. He's going to give the value of himself to the Beis Hamikdash. A person could say, you know what? I want to give what I'm financially worth to Hashem. Some gift. So go to the market. How much would, you know, a 58-year-old man go on the market to be sold as a slave? Whatever the market price is. Morris says various prices. For example, as a gimel. Then the estimation will be of a male from 20 years old to 6 years old, 50 shekels of silver. That's what I'm worth. According to the Torah, I'm worth 50 shekels. All right? Okay. So that is, he made a vow. Now he has to give that. He has to give that. So it uses, you see the same expression by both. It says in Pasuk Beis, my highlight isn't working. Again, you see the word, oh, Yafli. It says Yafli over here too. Yafli when you vow to give the value of yourself. It says Yafli when you vow to become a Nazir. Those are two types of vows. So we're talking about vows. Well, clearly we know that you've made a vow. Where do we say anything about releasing from a vow? We'll see in a minute.
Here is quite specific. There's no ifs or buts about what the
what the vow is, but what about the releasing of the vow? That's, remember, that's the issue. The Mishnah is talking about the releasing of the vow is not. So he's going to say, no, I'm going to show you where we're going to see the releasing of a vow as well. But it's interesting, it uses the expression yafli twice. That's the thing we got to know. Shenemar ki yafli shnei pa'amim. Okay, now, why does it have to say twice? This idea, when there's similar topics, say it once. So it says, you know, it says yafli, achas haflo le'isur. One time, it's an utterance. Hafla really means to clearly utter. If you want to really translate that literally, it's not an ambiguous vow, you know, someone clear. Kiafli. So one is to clearly utter, to prohibit it upon yourself. V'achas hafla laheter. And one is to clearly utter that it's permitted. Let's take a look at the note over here. The word yafli shall clearly utter denotes explication. By meaning clear, right? Make explicit, explicit. By twice using this expression in the context of vowing, the Torah indicates that a person undertaking a vow is called upon to explain himself twice. To explain himself once when he articulates the terms of the vow, and again when he seeks to be released from the vow, when he elaborates before the sage that what the vow was, what his intentions were when he undertook it, and by which means he was led to regret his vow, thus giving the sage the means to annulling it. In other words, it says twice you clearly articulate. Why does it have to say two times to clearly articulate? One time is to clearly articulate the vow itself, and once to clearly articulate how to get out of the vow. A very solid proof it isn't. It's a very distant hint. So that's what Rabbi Eliezer is saying. What do you mean it's not anywhere in the Torah? Now, I don't know if it, me and you would read it, I wouldn't see it that way. But he says that extra kiyafli, that's the little hint that you can release it. That's the way he looks at it. We'll see. Rabbi Shua says he's going to find a different source to this. Yesh l'mamash yisrohu, releasing vows has a scriptural support, and it's a different scriptural support. Shenemar, now we're talking about the sin of the golden calf, I think. The sin of the spies. David HaMelech writes in Tehillim, it says, Asher nishbati be'api. He's speaking for Hashem. For it stated, therefore I have sworn in my wrath. Hashem says, I swore in my anger that they will not come to my resting place. The minute the generation who left Egypt will not bring into Israel. After the sin of the spies, God swore. He made a vow. They ain't going in. So what's Hashem saying? Asher nishbati be'api. When I swore in my anger, and they're not going to go. Now, be'api, but there's another pasuk that said, it implies the following. Be'api nishbati, I swore in my anger, but therefore, v'chazar to be, and therefore I can retract. What does that mean? Let's look at the commentary. Although God did not in fact retract this vow, for the generation of Exodus indeed died out in the wilderness and did not enter the land of Israel. Nevertheless, the language of the verse implies that a vow uttered in wrath. Why did he have to say, I made an oath in my anger? Why does it just say I made an oath and I wasn't angry? Nevertheless, the language of vow uttered in wrath differs from an ordinary vow in that not having been uttered in a calm frame of mind, it can be annulled. Now, obviously, you know, we have to understand Hashem doesn't get angry. Hashem doesn't change his mind. It's just, a way for us to try to understand a little bit.
Because but, when you do something in anger, you're not rational.
Right. Now, we're not going to say Hashem wasn't rational, but he did in a way that it would be perceived by us as if it was anger. Likewise, any vow can be annulled if it can be established that when the person undertook the vow, his frame of mind was such he did not foresee certain subsequent events which, had he foreseen them, would have kept him from making the vow. When you're angry, you don't think all things through. Okay, alternatively, when the verse states that God vowed not to bring the generation of Exodus to his resting place, first not to the land of Israel, rather to the world to come. Whoa. And this vow, according to Yeshua, actually was annulled. For he maintains, Machlokas, that the generation of Exodus eventually did merit the world to come. Okay, so that's where you see he nulled his vow. He says, I swear my anger, they're not gonna see the promised land of the world to come. And guess what? This opinion holds, they did get to go to Olam Haba. So therefore you see that God himself annulled his vow. Why? Because he did it in anger. A vow in anger can be annulled. So that's a second opinion. That's also just a hint. It's not overtly clear, but it's a hint. Rav Yitzchak Omer, another source. Yesh Olam Haba Yisrael, a third way of looking at it. Shenemar, the Pasuk says like this, this is the building of the Mishkan now. It says by the building of Mishkan, who gave to the Mishkan? It says, Kol Nediv Libo, anyone of a philanthropic heart, a willing heart. Okay? So, let's see now. Rabbi Yitzchak sees in this verse an implication that even someone who had vowed to bring a donation was only required to put his vow into effect if his heart remained willing. Otherwise, he could be released from his vow. In other words, it's the classic, appeals in a shul.
That's right.
Right? The rabbi gives a heart-rendering appeal. Oh, we need this money. Oh, everyone's crying. Okay, $50,000, this and that. Right? Big philanthropic heart. He goes home and says, are you crazy? You know what that means? It means we're not going on vacations for the next 5 years. Oh, I forgot about that. And we're not going to do the renovation of the kitchen. Oh, I forgot about that. And our home marriage is finished. Oh, I forgot about that. You know what? I'm not so willing anymore. So in other words, and that's a vow. Giving to the Beis HaMikdash was a vow. So it has to always remain in that willing state. And they'd say, well, you know, if you knew your wife would divorce you if you give this donation, would you have made this donation? No, I'm not willing. So that's the third source. There's a fourth opinion. Chananya ben Achi, Rabbi Yeshua. Mer Chananya, the nephew of Rabbi Yeshua, says Yesh Lev Ayam Yisrael. He also says there is a scriptural hint. Shenemar, it says King David says the following: Nishbati va'akayema, I have sworn and I will fulfill Lishmor Mishpatei Tzidkecha, to keep your righteous ordinances. Now, obviously, if David HaMelech swore he would do it, does he have to say that he did it also? It says, I swore, I have sworn, and I will fulfill. I mean, David HaMelech, if he swears he's going to do it, what does he have to say, and I will fulfill? It's obvious he's going to do it. The verse implies that if he did not want to keep the vow, he could be released from it. I swore, and I will fulfill. And if you know what? Just because I swore doesn't mean I have to do it, because there's a way out, and I'm going to say I won't go with the way out. But there is a way out. These are the four opinions.
Ambiguous as well.
They're all just hints, yeah. Very remote hints. Well, guess what? Rabbi Yehuda, Omer Shmuel, doesn't like any of this.
That's right.
Omer Rabbi Yehuda, Omer Shmuel, he says, I havai hosom, if I would have been there when these rabbis were talking and finding these abstract hints, my hint is better than theirs. And let's see what his is. We'll do that, and then we'll stop after that. Shenemar, very simple. It talks about when a person makes a vow. Let's go to the vows. It says when you make a vow, it says, lo yachel divaro. You should not profane your words. You make a vow, don't profane your words. So, what does that mean? You cannot make those words. When you say a vow, it becomes holy. I am going to do whatever you're saying, it's holy. Yachel chulin means to profane, to make it unholy. So you can't, you are not, I who made the vow, cannot make my vow unholy. Ah, I can't make my vow unholy. But what about somebody else? Right? Who, Eina Mochel, the person who made the vow cannot profane it. Avol Acherim Mochlin Lo. But others can, so to speak, profane it and annul it. That is already a much clearer source. Let's take a look again. Where is this? 33. Let's just take a quick look. It says, verse 3. Ish ki yidor neder l'Hashem, o yishav ha-shvua lesor Yisrael nafsho, a person who makes a vow or an oath on himself, lo yachel dvaro, he shall not break his word. So now we could say, he cannot break his word, but maybe other people can break. That's clearly can be implied. He can't break his word, but others can break his word. How could somebody break his word? A rabbi could come and say, you know, you don't have to keep it anymore. And that is a much better, at least we're talking about this aspect. The others aren't even right on topic. This is right on the topic, right where a person makes a vow. It says you cannot profane your vow, but it says you can't profane your vow. The implication is others can, and how can others do it? If you go to a rabbi and you ask him to annul the vow, he can annul the vow. He says, I like mine better than the other. Who ain't a mochel? He cannot annul a vow. Acherim mochlin lo, others can.
Why is this different than the previous one we read from another rabbi? Well, you said the same thing. You take a vow, and then you go in front of Abed Din.
No, but that's not the text. I'm sorry. We know what the law is, but what was the source? The other four rabbis brought very unclear sources. I promise and I will do it. That tells me you can annul a vow. Or Hashem says, I swore in my anger. Those are very remote hints. This is right on the spot. It's going right on the aspect of making vows, and it says you may not profane your vow, which clearly implies you can't, but somebody else can. How could somebody else do it? Must be it's a bezin. That's a much...
So that reinforces the other.
The other ones, he's just saying like this. There were four rabbis got up and gave explanations, and I say, I don't buy them. I don't buy them. They're not so on the spot. And you'll see next week, he's going to show you each one of those four interpretations could be interpreted to teach you something else. While his is much more direct. It's much more direct. It's saying you can't annul it, which implies somebody else can. Oh, so that's the whole thing. That's the whole thing about Taurus Nedarim. And we'll stop
so
over day.
After the word.